Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, March 23rd, 2021. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, MISD Leaders Decide Mask Wearing Will Continue, by Stuart Doreen. The mask policy inside Midland ISD will not change. Despite having more people speak out against the status quo, the MISD board decided to leave the current policy in place. There was no motion to change the current policy that originally was handed down by the state. Reasons provided included listening to healthcare professionals, wanting to see a 2021-22 school year without mitigation, belief that masks have helped bring numbers down this year, and hearing from teachers, staff, and their spouses that they favor a mask policy. Midland ISD leaders sided with two school nurses that said wearing masks were creating healthier campuses. The school nurse at Santa Rita Elementary said because of masks, there has been a 72% drop in strep this year and a decrease in flu cases from 60 to 5. Those speaking against the current mask policy cited mental health, a better learning environment, the freedom of choice, and no longer wanting to be muzzled. They wanted Midland ISD to venture down paths traveled by school districts like Greenwood ISD and Big Spring ISD that already voted to give students and parents the ability to make their own decisions. According to statistics provided during the meeting, 78 of the 1,029 independent school districts have voted for parent or student choice. Their voices were those that had grown weary of the current COVID climate and the restrictions placed on residents. Some talked about the need of students to see their teachers' faces and the faces of other students. They talked about some students were not wearing masks like they were expected. Some talked about the changing nature of guidelines, and many addressed the lower COVID numbers inside Midland and in the community. It was mentioned during the meeting that the Reporter Telegram reported Monday that the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases was at its lowest weekly level going back to June. Still, a higher number of speakers against the ordinance, 10 to 4, according to a Reporter Telegram count, was not good enough to even get a vote. Katie Joyner spoke about the frustration of not knowing what the line was that the district needed to cross. Michael Booker also showed his frustration that the mask policy will continue. Imogene Douglas, the district's director of health services, told the board the district's recommendations to keep the system came after discussions with local healthcare professionals like Dr. Larry Wilson, Midland High's vice president of medical affairs. She also said vaccines are not 100% effective, that it is not known what the longer-term trends will be, that Midland County's cases have gone down through peaks and valleys, and that masks have helped reduce the number of students needing to be quarantined and the number missing school. Board members do hope that leaving the mask policy in place will make for a safer environment to bring parents and visitors on campus to help with learning experiences and PTA meetings. They also hope that measures followed now will mean 2021-22 will be without masks. This article is entitled, County Residents Could Have Water Within a Year Once Project Begins. Court Learns of Potential Costs Inside Area and at Winkler County Water Sources, by Caitlin Randall. Midland County residents could have access to city's water system within a year after initial construction begins, officials said Monday. Jay Edwards of the engineering firm Parkhill Smith & Cooper said during Monday Commissioner's Court meeting that a project to tie into the city's distribution system from two places in the county could be completed within a year. That would require four entities, the City of Midland, Midland County, the Midland County Utility District, and the Midland County Freshwater District to enter into an interlocal agreement. Those groups met last Friday to hear a presentation from Edwards and discuss the undertaking. During the first phase of the project, two connections would be installed at Edgewood and Sprayberry Drives, Edwards said. The maximum volumes would be 2,000 gallons per minute at the Edgewood location and 1,500 gallons per minute at the Sprayberry location. Construction of the two connections would cost the county $7.9 million, as well as wholesale water rates of $4.90 per 1,000 gallons for 0 to 2 million gallons of water a day, or $6.64 per 1,000 gallons for 2 million to 5 million gallons per day, which would be paid to the city monthly. Bringing water to county residents who rely on wells or water transported from third-party vendors is an endeavor years in the making. The county purchased water rights and land in Winkler County 6 years ago with the goal of developing that land into a water field. James Wise of the Greater Gardendale Water Supply, a rural water system that serves Midland and Ector counties, said during Monday's meeting that they've been trying to find a secondary water source for the last decade. We started our water supply corporation in 2002. In 2014, we had to limit the number of taps that we can provide to people because we didn't have enough water, he said. Wise said they're currently only able to provide water to residential customers because there's not enough supply for commercial entities. Commissioner Luis Sanchez, whose district encompasses many county residents that would benefit from access to water, previously told the Reporter-Telegram bringing a water source to the county would allow for commercial development, including construction of schools. After the first phase is completed, construction would begin on developing the county's land in Winkler County, called Rourke Ranch, into a water field, which the county would pay $26 million for between fiscal years 2021 to 24. Edwards said development of Rourke Ranch could be completed within 2.5 years. The next phase would see the Midland County Utility District build a pipeline to send water from Rourke Ranch to the county through the city-owned T-Bar Ranch, also in Winkler County. Construction of the pipeline would cost the county another $24 million to be budgeted for fiscal years 2024 to 26. Grants from the Texas Water Development Board and EPA could cover some of the funding. Edwards said a survey by Parkhill, Smith & Cooper found there are as many as 40,000 people living in the county. Any residents who wanted to tap into the city's water system would need to plat their property prior to connection if the property is less than 5 acres, he said. County Judge Terry Johnson said the project would be historic if all the entities can reach an agreement. It's been a long time coming, Edwards said. There's a lot of desperate need out there. This article is entitled, Craddock Addresses Grave Concerns About Landgraf's Radioactive Waste Bill, by Stuart Doreen. State Representative Tom Craddock sent a letter to House Committee on Environmental Regulation members that states he has grave concerns about Brooks Landgraf's Radioactive Waste Bill, House Bill 2692. The following is a copy of the letter sent Monday. It references the low-level waste site in Andrews County and how the bill muddies the waters between a tax cut for a specific vendor and the issue of high-level radioactive waste storage in Texas. These are separate issues which should not be considered in a single piece of legislation, Craddock wrote. Landgraf's bill would ban the storage and disposal of high-level nuclear waste away from civilian nuclear power plants or university research reactors in Texas. A proposal from waste control specialists to expand their existing nuclear waste site in Andrews County to store high-level waste would be impacted by the bill. Craddock writes that the high-level radioactive waste storage in Texas is a decision first reserved to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC. The former Speaker of the House also wrote that the legislation as drafted allows an upside to the current license holder by reducing fees and surcharges with no benefit to the state of Texas. This results in a negative fiscal impact to our budget, Craddock wrote. Moreover, it also eliminates the limits on the amount of waste the license holder can move into the facility each year. While the fiscal impact is in and of itself a cause for pause, the reduction in fees has multiple effects on Texas. Reducing these fees is most certainly going to lead to greater profits by the license holder and a rapid influx of low-level waste in the facility. Removing the annual capacity limits allows the license holder to sell waste disposal as fast as they can. That means increased waste transported across both your and my district. This poses a safety risk for all Texans. The Midland Republican also states that Landgraf's bill, as drafted, removes TECQ's ability to review the license holder's contracts for waste entering the site on Texas soil. Why would a member of the Texas House support a loss of contractual oversight while at the same time providing the license holder a tax boost? Craddock wrote. Lastly, Craddock wrote the legislation also changes the requirements regarding containerization. When the initial legislation was passed, there were extensive negotiations around the containerization of all waste stored at the Andrews site, Craddock wrote. The bill would no longer require the containerization of Class A waste. It does leave in place the requirements for Class B and Class C waste to be containerized. There has not been a substantial change in the geology or decrease in the population since the legislation approved the site. Thus, it is not in the interest of the Permian Basin or these communities to have the waste storage requirements reduced. The following is a copy of the letter sent from State Representative Tom Craddock, Republican Midland, to members of the House Committee on Environmental Regulation. Dear Member of Environmental Regulation Committee, today the Texas House Committee on Environmental Regulation will take up a very important matter to my district. House Bill 2692 by Chairman Landgraf is in regards to the regulation of radioactive waste. The legislation reduces both surcharges and fees. I have represented the Permian Basin for over 50 years. I voted for the creation of the low-level waste site in Andrews County. The site is ideal for low-level radioactive waste storage and provides a financial benefit to the state of Texas. However, the legislation then versus the legislation now have significant differences. I have grave concerns about the legislation before you in committee today. House Bill 2692 is quite frankly a vendor bill. It muddies the waters between a tax cut for a specific vendor and the issue of high-level radioactive waste storage in Texas. These are separate issues which should not be considered in a single piece of legislation. In press releases and other talking points, this legislation has been marked as a ban on high-level radioactive waste storage. I am not convinced. High-level radioactive waste storage in Texas is a decision first reserved to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC. The current license holder has a business interest in a company with a pending application before the NRC for a high-level radioactive waste storage site in Texas. If, in fact, the license holder, WCS, has no interest in high-level radioactive waste being stored in Texas, why have they not revoked this application? The legislation as drafted allows an upside to the current license holder by reducing fees and surcharges with no benefit to the state of Texas. This results in a negative fiscal impact to our budget. Moreover, it also eliminates the limits on the amount of waste the license holder can move into the facility each year. While the fiscal impact is in and of itself a cause for pause, The reduction in fees has multiple effects on Texas. Reducing these fees is most certainly going to lead to greater profits by the license holder and a rapid influx of low-level waste in the facility. Removing the annual capacity limits allows the license holder to sell waste disposal as fast as they can. This means increased waste transported across both your and my district. This poses a safety risk for all Texans. The Permian Basin is an asset to my community, to Texas, and to our financial position in the global markets. The oil and gas resources in this basin are unparalleled in the nation. The Permian Basin produces 4.2 billion barrels of crude per year. Texas generates 40% of the United States oil production, and the Permian Basin alone accounts for 70% of the United States production. This is not a resource we want to jeopardize now or in the future. You would not want an accident on a highway or railway in your district involving radioactive waste, and I most certainly do not want to risk such in mine. House Bill 2692 goes a step further and reduces the oversight by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, TCEQ. The bill as drafted removes TCEQ's ability to review the license holder's contracts for waste entering the site on Texas soil. Why would a member of the Texas House support a loss of contractual oversight while at the same time providing the license holder a tax boost? We would not. The legislation also changes the requirements regarding containerization. When the initial legislation was passed, there were extensive negotiations around the containerization of all waste stored at the Andrews site. The bill would no longer require the containerization of Class A waste. It does leave in place the requirements for Class B and Class C waste to be containerized. There has not been a substantial change in the geology or decrease in the population since the legislation approving the site. Thus, it is not in the interest of the Permian Basin or these communities to have the waste storage requirements reduced. I appreciate you taking the time to fully review this legislation and its impacts to the state of Texas. I look forward to working with you on a resolution to send to Congress and the NRC with a clear message: Texas has no interest in the transport or storage of high-level radioactive waste. Best regards, Tom Craddock, State Representative, House District 82. This is the local page. This article is entitled "Pfluger Addresses Midland Migrant Facility at Town Hall" by Caitlin Randall. Representative August Pfluger held a town hall meeting Monday night to discuss current legislation on the House floor and the migrant facility for unaccompanied children that opened in Midland County on March 14th. The town hall came after local officials said last week that they were left in the dark about a man camp in Midland County being converted into a facility for up to 700 teenage migrants. "I'm furious about what happened under the cover of darkness, in the shroud of night in this community," Pfluger said during Monday's town hall. The Biden administration has continued a Trump-era policy of not allowing families to cross the border because of COVID-19. But unaccompanied children are able to enter the country and connect with relatives in the U.S. Pfluger said that rule incentivizes cartels and traffickers to use minors. "They may have stopped family units, but they've opened up Pandora's box when it comes to exploiting children," he said. In an interview following the town hall, Pfluger said he believes the Biden administration should reinstitute asylum agreements with Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras that require migrants traveling to the U.S. to apply for protections in those countries first. He also blamed the current administration's rhetoric for the crisis at the border, saying because of Democrats' policies, the number of illegal immigrants seeking to cross the U.S.-Mexico border has almost tripled year over year. "The children don't know these policies. It's the traffickers, the criminals, and the cartels that know these policies. So I hold those people accountable for what they're doing to the children," Pfluger said. District Attorney Laura Nodolf attended the town hall and presented Pfluger with a copy of a public records request she said she emailed to U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas. She requested a copy of the contract with Cotton Logistics Main Camp, as well as information regarding the backgrounds of the children and the care they're receiving. They refused to answer our questions, to the point that I had to send an open records request simply to get answers, she said in an interview. Nodolf said she will proceed with an appeals process if she's denied the documents that she's requested. We just want to know how to best handle the situation to ensure the safety of our community, the safety of our law enforcement, and the safety of the children who are truly innocent lives, she said. Pfluger also addressed the recently passed stimulus bill, which he said he opposed, and the House Resolutions 1 and 8 during the town hall. House Resolution 1, or For the People Act, would expand voting rights, change campaign finance laws, and more. Pfluger said the bill is nothing short of a power grab from the federal government. H.R. 8 is a universal background checks bill that Pfluger said would allow the FBI to delay applications for firearms by up to 20 days. The end goal is to have a national registry, so every person is registered and they know where and how many and what types of weapons you have, he said. This is the local and state page. This article is entitled COVID Cases Down to 8-Month Low by Stuart Doreen. The Midland Health Department reported the lowest number of confirmed weekly COVID cases in 2021 and more. The 61 COVID cases from March 14th to the 20th were lower than the 104 cases during the previous week. They were also less than 8% of the total cases from the first full week of 2021. But the decline in Midland County is more historical. Reporter-Telegram records show the 61 cases this past week marked the first time since September 6th to the 12th that there were less than 100 confirmed cases in a week inside Midland County. The number of cases this past week also was the lowest weekly total going back to June 7th to the 13th, 46. There were 5 cases reported Sunday, bringing the total number of cases during the pandemic through March 21st to 16,852. The city of Midland also is reporting 247 COVID-19 related deaths during the pandemic. Other notables include a 3.4% positivity rate at Midland Health Testing Centers, the lowest this year, 618 total tests at Midland Health facilities and only 21 positive cases, also the lowest total in 2021. The number of vaccines provided by Midland Health topped 70,681, including 7,234 vaccines administered at the Horseshoe this past week. 6% of the total number of patients inside Midland Memorial are COVID-19 patients. There were 11 active COVID patients on Monday morning and 4 more convalescing COVID patients. The 6% figure is tied for the lowest percentage this year. This article is entitled National Weather Service. Winds gust to 56 miles per hour Monday. From staff reports. The National Weather Service reported fierce winds on Monday. The NWS showed sustained winds reaching 41 miles per hour and gusts topping out at 56 miles per hour at Midland International, according to the Daily Climatological Report. Those are the high marks for this month and 2021, according to the NWS. Monday's top wind speeds do fall short of records for any March in Midland. The National Weather Service showed a top sustained wind speed of 53 miles per hour on March 27, 1984, and top gust or peak wind speed of 74 miles per hour, also March 27, 1984. Tuesday will provide a break, 5 to 15 miles an hour, before gusts again climb higher than 30 miles an hour on Wednesday. This article is called Area Briefs from Staff Reports. Amarillo woman dies in crash on U.S. 385. A 26-year-old Amarillo woman died at the scene after a collision Sunday afternoon on U.S. Highway 385 just outside of Crane. DPS reported that Stephanie V. Tijerino of Amarillo was traveling north in her Nissan Altima when she failed to drive in a single lane and collided with a 2010 Peterbilt truck tractor that was towing a semi-trailer. The Peterbilt truck tractor was driving south on 385, 1 mile south of Crane. DPS reported the accident happened around 2:30 p.m. on Sunday. Andrews man, one of two dead after crash on 1788. A 28-year-old Andrews man died Sunday morning after a crash 11 miles east of Andrews on Farm to Market Road 1788, according to the Department of Public Safety. DPS reported that Francisco Del Hierro was one of two people dead at the scene after two Dodge Ram pickup trucks collided. The other man was Colton J. Gibbs, 30, of Gladewater. The accident took place around 3:48 a.m. on Sunday morning. Del Hierro and Gibbs were the only occupants of their respective vehicles. DPS reported Monday that Gibbs' Dodge Ram 1500 was traveling south on FM 1788. Del Hierro was traveling north in a Dodge Ram 2500. DPS stated that its preliminary investigation showed Del Hierro's vehicle entered the southbound lane and struck Gibbs's vehicle head-on.
Town Hall Meeting. U.S. Representative August Pfluger speaks about immigration and border security during a town hall meeting Monday afternoon at the Bush Convention Center in Midland.
This is the obituary column, March 23rd, 2021. Elicio Gomez Montoya. Elicio Gomez Montoya, 91, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, March 20th. A viewing will begin at 12 p.m. Tuesday, March 23rd, and rosary at 7 p.m. at Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel in Midland. Services will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday, March 24th, at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church. Interment would follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Elicio was born on January 1, 1930, in El Mulato, Mexico, to Antonio Gomez and Bernarda Montoya. Elicio was survived by his children, Jesus Antonio Gomez, wife Berenice, Rosario Zapata, husband Hilario, and Elicio Gomez, wife Laura, his 11 grandchildren and two great-grandchildren. Elicio was preceded in death by his wife Maria Elia, his parents Antonio and Bernarda, his brothers Carmen Pascasio, Octavio, Manuel, his sisters Evangelina, Rosa, and Balbina, his nephews Margarito Gomez and Eleazar Gomez. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Linda McMillan. Linda McMillan, 81, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, March 20th. A memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, March 24th, at Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Linda was born on November 11, 1939, in Abilene, Texas, to Hugh and Grace Stockton. Linda is survived by daughters Terry Hawkins and Melinda Vinson, stepson Chad McMillan and wife Nancy Jane, stepdaughter Marky McMillan, brother Jerry Stockton and wife Lenora, 9 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren. Linda is preceded in death by her husband, Bobby McMillan, and her sister, Joanne Martin. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. Brenda Travis. Brenda Travis, 59, of Midland, passed away March 21st. The family will receive guests from 6 to 8 p.m. Thursday, March 25th at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, March 26th at Fairmont Park Church of Christ, with interment following at Sunset Memorial Gardens in Odessa. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Lorena Sanchez. Lorena Sanchez, 44, of Midland, passed away on Thursday, March 18th. Viewing will be held on Thursday, March 25th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Friday, March 26th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a prayer service and rosary to be recited that evening at 7 p.m. at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home Chapel. She is survived by her husband, Gabriel Sanchez, three sons, Andrew Gomez, Jacob Sanchez, and Gabriel Sanchez, daughter Danielle Sanchez, brother Ricardo Gomez, two sisters, Ava Gardea and Olga Williams, seven grandchildren, numerous nephews, nieces, and cousins. Maria Madrid. Maria Madrid, 95, of Midland, passed away on Sunday, March 21st. Viewings will be held on Wednesday, March 24th, from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., Thursday, March 25th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., and Friday, March 26th, from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Rosary will be recited Thursday evening at 7 p.m., also at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral Mass is set for Friday, March 26th at 2 p.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial will follow to Rest Haven North. She is survived by four daughters, Mary Terrazas, Yolanda Sosa, Hilda Armendariz, and Norma Madrid. One sister, Ida F. Benavides, six grandchildren, nine great-grandchildren, three great-great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces, nephews, and cousins. Robert Jason Parks. Robert Jason Parks of Midland passed away March 19th. There is no service planned. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. W.T. Leroy Ledford. W.T. Leroy Ledford, 86, of Midland, passed away March 19th. The family will receive guests from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Wednesday, March 24th at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, March 25th at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Survivors include wife Mary Sue Scott Ledford and children Glenn Roy Ledford, Carol Sue Ledford, Martin Wayne Ledford, David Bryant Ledford, Sandra Renee Ledford, and Michael Wade Ledford.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, March 23rd, 2021. County burn ban considered. Court reviews sheriff's technology improvements. OA News at OAOA.com. After county commissioners today will consider enacting a countywide burn ban and review making extensive improvements to the county library. In the 10 a.m. meeting at the County Administration Building at 1010 East 8th Street, they will also discuss upgrading the sheriff's technological capabilities with the purchase of $404,433 in equipment. Precinct 1 Commissioner Mike Gardner is scheduled to review the need for a burn ban, which would prohibit all outside burning except under the supervision of a fire department, owing to the steadily worsening drought conditions that the Permian Basin has seen this late winter and early spring. The court is slated to review the heating and cooling needs and a prospective list of repairs at the county library and consider adding it to the county's energy savings contract with Johnson Controls for a cost of $1.5 million. Totaling $13,508, the library's annual list of gifts and memorials will also be considered. Sheriff Mike Griffiths will seek the purchase of 27 laptop docking stations and 27 input car adapters for $25,671 from GTS Technology Solutions, 27 cameras for $262,197 from Axon Enterprise, 44 automated external defibrillators for $57,288 from AED First Response, 27 cradle points, harnesses, and service plans for $36,584 from Verizon Wireless, 54 monitors for $5,224 from Loaded Dice Safety, and Streamlight LED flashlights for $3,240 from Streamlight Stinger. In other action, the court will consider medical examiner Ron Inga's request for 2 Nikon cameras and accessories to be bought with CARES Act money, hear a proposal to adjust to an increased work demand and extend seasonal employees through the end of the year, consider transferring $70,000 from road maintenance to salaries in the Highways and Streets Department, review extending online auctioneering services. Opportunity Culture Expanding Next Fall by Ruth Campbell, rcampbell@oaoa.com. A program to place effective teachers in front of more Ector County ISD students is expanding this coming school year to more campuses. Executive Director of Talent Development Ashley Osborne said 10 campuses are going to be added to the Opportunity Culture arsenal. The district currently has 8 Opportunity Culture campuses. The ECISD website says Opportunity Culture is an innovative approach to staffing that multiplies the impact of highly effective teachers, thereby improving student performance. Opportunity Culture also enhances efforts to recruit and retain highly qualified instructors by offering career advancement opportunities, sustainable higher pay, and on-the-job professional development and support. Bringing Opportunity Culture to the Permian Basin is a result of partnerships with Public Impact, U.S. Prep, and the University of Texas Permian Basin, the site says. The second set of campuses is being called Cohort B. Those campus design teams made up of the principal and whoever else that the principal assigns to be on that campus design team are receiving training right now in the principles of opportunity culture, what are the benefits, how to think differently about staffing. Also, what are the roles within opportunity culture, and then they are building their campus plan, Osborne said. So they're basically determining how many multi-classroom leaders they can have, what grade levels they need them at. They're basically coming up with their staffing plan, and that's why we're hiring for all of those positions, she added. A multi-classroom leader, she said, is an excellent teacher who teaches students but also has a coaching responsibility. So they provide professional learning and coaching for teachers that are on their team, Osborne said. Applications are being taken from the area and outside of it. We encourage anyone, whether they're from our district or an outside applicant, to apply, Osborne said. The process is very rigorous because the multi-classroom leaders have to show that they're effective in the classroom with students. They also will have coaching responsibility. They have to submit artifacts such as student achievement data, student growth data, evaluation data, an essay, and a letter of recommendation. They have to submit all those things, and then they're reviewed. If they meet a minimal threshold scoring with those artifacts, then they're interviewed at the district level. If they pass that level, then they are put into a pool where Opportunity Culture campuses can schedule interviews if that teacher meets whatever MCL need they have for their campus. We have a priority deadline. We will accept applications beyond this deadline, but we do have a priority deadline of March 30th, Osborne said. She said campuses will start hiring for these positions in early April, and those hired would start next fall. There will be training over the summer, but there will be training over the summer primarily for coaching, since that is a large part of their job. Overall, Osborne said Opportunity Culture has gone well. We're excited about the progress that we're seeing. What's so awesome is we have such a great partnership with Public Impact, who is the nonprofit that we're partnering with to implement Opportunity Culture, Osborne said. Another thing that has come out of Opportunity Culture is a contribution to the district pipeline to get more skilled teachers into classrooms. We're partnering with UTPB and USPREP, US Prep, to do that work, Osborne said. They're supplying us with teacher residents that are part of this, and the teacher resident partners with a multi-classroom leader. They're seniors at the university. They will graduate with their bachelor's and teaching certificate, so they're learning right alongside that multi-classroom leader. We've had some really great outcomes from those teacher residents, and we're excited to hire them as teachers, she said. She added that the goal of implementing Opportunity Culture is to get strong, effective teachers in front of the most at-risk students. That is ultimately the goal, to have more kids be taught by highly effective teachers, and the way that we're going to do that is by employing these great, great teachers and then growing other teachers that we employ. Abigail Adami Herrera, a 7th grade English teacher at Wilson and Young Medal of Honor Middle School, is a first-year teacher. Adami Herrera said Principal Anthony Garcia let her know that she would have a lot of support. Adami Herrera is from California. My husband was in the military, and we lived in Killeen, Texas, which is like Central Texas, a military town. He did like a training program for GM, and then Sewell was hiring out here. He ended up interviewing with them. We came out here. At the time when we came out here, I was still in my last semester of college. And so then I applied last summer to be a substitute teacher because I didn't think I could get all the stuff that I needed to be a first-year teacher, but it ended up working out. I did. And then I applied. I decided to come here, Adami Herrera said. Middle school wasn't what she wanted to teach. She thought she wanted to instruct older students. It just ended up that middle school positions were open, and the age group seemed right, she said. Adami Herrera said she was drawn to teaching because she had so many great teachers that changed her for the better. I just never believed in myself, and my teachers always did, and I want to do that for someone. I want to be that for somebody else, she added. She earned a bachelor's degree in English literature from Arizona State University. She did her first 2 semesters in person and the rest online. Adami Herrera said she loves her profession so far. It's more than I thought. Being a student for so long, it's like now, like you're behind the scenes. It's like when you watch movies and you just see it all happen, she said. She had heard and read about the negative aspects of teaching, but she hasn't found that at Wilson and Young. I think because we're united and we have that person to unite us, the multi-classroom leader. We just know that we can go to one another and we constantly collaborate and we're constantly sharing ideas. So never in this year have I felt like, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm doing, because I know there's always somebody that I can reach out to. I have a feeling like that's something special, Adami Herrera said. For his part, Garcia said opportunity culture has helped build a collaborative environment of motivated teachers who are eager to learn and grow. I am excited to have a group of rock star teachers, he said in a text message. On the net, www.hectorcountyisd.org/opportunity culture. 416 days. For 416 days, the city has fought a lawsuit brought by the Odessa American to enforce the state law that guarantees the public's right to see basic police records. Through January 6th, the city has spent $112,138.47 of taxpayers' dollars to fight releasing information on crime in Odessa. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Hector County, 16,528 total cases, 348 deaths. ECISD daily cases, 6 students, 2 staff. Midland County, 16,829 total cases, 258 deaths. Texas, 2,754,616 total cases, 47,346 deaths. U.S. cases, 29,652,483 total confirmed, and 539,517 deaths. Find out more at covidinthebasin.com or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. See the ECISD COVID-19 dashboard at tinyurl.com/Y6NTPTUQ. COVID-19 vaccines. Medical Center Hospital is administering COVID-19 first dose Pfizer vaccines from 9 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. Monday through Friday, and from 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. Saturday and Sunday at MCH Urgent Care locations at 3001 JBS Parkway and at 6030 West University Boulevard. Vaccines are for Phase 1A frontline workers and residents at long-term care facilities, and Phase 1B, most at risk for ages 65 and older. No appointment is necessary and walk-ins are welcome. Vaccines are free of charge while supplies last. Visit mchodessa.com/coronavirus. Odessa Regional Medical Center, 520 East 6th Street, is administering COVID-19 vaccines. Vaccines are free of charge while supplies last. To check on availability or to make an appointment, call 432-582-8549. That's 432-582-8549. Or visit www.odessaregionalmedicalcenter.org/vaccine. ORMC will contact those who received the first dose, Pfizer dose, at Ratliff to set their second/booster shot appointment. The Hector County Health Department, 221 North Texas Avenue, are administering COVID-19 Pfizer vaccines. Vaccines are free of charge while supplies last. The vaccines are for healthcare workers, school/childcare employees, anyone with a chronic condition, and for those 50 years and older. To schedule an appointment, call 432-498-4141, option 0. Visit www.facebook.com/Hector County Health Department or www.co.hector.gov www.mdph.tx.us/page/ector.coronavirus-COVID-19. John Garcia, MD, PA, West Texas Wellness Clinic, 2453 East 11th Street, is administering COVID-19 vaccines while supplies last. To make an appointment or for more information, call 582-0300 or visit www.facebook.com/JGARCIA123 or westtexaswellness.com. Walgreens has limited COVID-19 vaccines available in select areas. For eligibility requirements or more information, visit tinyurl.com/YHR6NEUD. HEB pharmacies are administering the COVID-19 vaccine based on state and federal eligibility guidelines in select areas. To sign up, updates, or information, visit vaccine.heb.com. The CVS stores are administering the COVID-19 vaccine by appointment only in select stores based on local eligibility guidelines. For guidelines, to schedule an appointment, or for more information, visit cvs.com, CVS Pharmacy app, or call 800-746-7287. United Supermarkets will be administering free COVID-19 vaccines soon. For updates, visit www.unitedsupermarkets.com/COVID-19-vaccine. Walmart and Sam's Club pharmacies are administering the COVID-19 vaccine based on state and federal eligibility guidelines in select areas. For guidelines, to schedule an appointment, or for more information, visit www.walmart.com/CP/1228302 or www.samsclub.com/pharmacy. Quick Hits. Oil and Gas Convention. The Roseland West Texas Oil and Gas Convention has been scheduled Wednesday and Thursday at the Midland County Horseshoe Arena, 2514 Arena Trail, Midland. Doors open at 9 a.m. For more information, visit tinyurl.com/M8D9FVC, RoselandConsulting.com, or MidlandHorseshoe.com. From Staff Reports. Closing prices. Posted $58.03. Futures $61.55. Natural gas $2.582. Benchmark U.S. rose 13 cents to $61.55 per barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Three charged with violations of SOB ordinance. OANews@OAOA.com. Three men were arrested after Odessa Police Department officers reportedly contacted more than 15 entertainers and non-entertainers at a strip club inside city limits that weren't displaying permits required by city ordinance and didn't possess permits issued by the city of Odessa. Alberto Rodriguez, 41, and Nikolai Arcutt, 44, were each charged with operating a sexually oriented business without a license, a Class A misdemeanor, while Luis Carrizosa, 20, was charged with violating a sexually oriented business ordinance, a Class A misdemeanor. The reported violation happened around 9:33 p.m. Thursday as OPD officers were conducting an inspection of Jaguar's nightclub located at 6824 Cargo Road, the affidavit stated. Uniformed officers reportedly determined the business was actively involved in sexually oriented activity as defined by Odessa City Ordinance Chapter 4-5. The management of Jaguars had been previously notified in writing of the requirements to obtain a business license and other requirements under the ordinance. Management provided documentation which showed their receipt and understanding of the requirements to obtain a permit by law. Officers reportedly saw entertainers and non-entertainers engaged in conduct which requires a sexually oriented business license. Officers contacted more than 15 entertainers and non-entertainers that weren't displaying permits as required by ordinance and didn't possess permits issued by the City of Odessa. Officers contacted the self-identified manager, Rodriguez, who has read his Miranda rights and admitted to being the on-duty manager, having worked at this nightclub for the past 6 years, the affidavit stated. Rodriguez wasn't able to produce a lawfully issued sexually-oriented business license. Garzosa was reportedly acting as a bouncer for the nightclub and also didn't possess a permit as required by law. Carrizosa also failed to identify himself to a uniformed police officer as required by law. Carrizosa wasn't identified until officers physically recovered a driver's license from his wallet. A short time after conducting the inspection, Orcutt arrived at the nightclub, the affidavit stated. He had his attorney on the phone during the contact and during the interview. Orcutt's attorney acknowledged the receipt of notification of the requirements for a sexually oriented business license and the fact that Orcutt was a regional guy and the request to not arrest and that Orcutt will close the nightclub. Officers reportedly detailed that Orcutt, based upon his attorney and his arrival in response to the police inspection, demonstrated that he was clearly in control, managed and oversaw all actions with the business. Orcutt had the authority to close the business. Orcutt, Rodriguez, and Carrizosa were arrested and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center without incident. All three men had one bond, totaling $1,000, and each posted bail on March 19th, jail records show.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.